This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Creates it equal.
The Reconstruction Amendments marks the shift from thinking of ourselves as a republic to thinking of ourselves as a democracy.
You know, if something's a fundamental right, then you shouldn't have to test your way into accessing that fundamental right.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Gary Jr. II.
Hello, Stephen. What are we talking about today?
Today, we're actually looking back at an old episode of Created Equal from 2021, where we were discussing the Constitution over that summer, and we had a conversation in the office about voting rights and all of the struggles around voting rights and how long they have taken. And I said, well, you know, the right to vote is actually not explicitly protected in the U.S. Constitution. It's not a stated individual right. And people were kind of surprised by that, the producers and other folks in the office. So we put together a show with two constitutional experts to talk about why is that true and does that have something to do with how hard it's been to make sure that people get the right to vote and have that right protected.
So it's similar to the spirit of when you were talking about the voting rights for Trump voters.
Yes,
it's
right.
The fact that there's an ambiguity there because in the Constitution it's not clearly stated.
Yeah, and if you think about the history of this country, so much of it has been about trying to make sure that more people have the right to vote than originally did and that their rights to vote are protected in the right way, mm-hmm. right? So that it's not easy to make someone's vote not count or to prevent them from casting a ballot.
So really the conversation is like, because it was unclear, how have we pieced together this right to vote that we've conceptualized now that we feel like we've understood so clearly that actually isn't defined?
Right. And would it be better? Would mm-hmm. it be easier to do some of the things we're trying to do if there were just a clause somewhere in the Constitution or an amendment to it that says, here's what the right to vote is, here's who it extends to? We do a lot of fighting in this country about mm-hmm. voting and voting rights. We don't often pause to say, well, how come they couldn't be structured differently, or how could it be structured differently?
And that's where we begin the conversation today. And I've got two really great guests who are experts in this field to help us shape this conversation. Theodore Johnson is a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Theodore, welcome to Detroit today.
Thank you. It's great to be here as usual.
And also with us is Bertrell Ross, who is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and a constitutional law expert who focuses on election law and voting rights. Professor Ross, welcome to Detroit today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's good to be here, and thanks for having me.
So, Professor Ross, I'm going to start with the history here. As I mentioned in the intro, voting rights were not addressed or explicitly included in the Constitution when it was first written and adopted. And free and fair elections are still not really guaranteed under current constitutional law, even in 2021. You say that, quote, part of the democratic struggle in the United States has been undoing some of the anti-democratic features of the original Constitution. Let's talk about why the authors of the Constitution neglected to tackle voting rights and embraced instead these anti-democratic ideas.
Yeah, you have to remember what the Constitution was responding to. The Constitution was responding to a tumultuous decade in the 1780s in the states, in which Revolutionary War debts left many people in a pretty depressed state economically. And so you saw the people seeking from their state governments different forms of debt relief through the exercise of voice, through petitions and voting when they could. And that led to some rebellions in states, such as the Shays Rebellion in Massachusetts. And what the framers of the Constitution were concerned about, among other things, was a little bit too much democracy, too much participation by the people in governance that posed a threat to property. Now, those who were involved in framing the Constitution were the propertied elite. They were the leading proponents of the Constitution. And so they sought to set up a government that provided protection for property rights against the wishes of the masses. So even if we leave aside the women who were denied the vote because they were seen as too dependent on the men and incapable of voting, or the African-Americans and the enslaved individuals in the South who were denied the vote for obvious racist reasons, even amongst the white polity, there was a sense that only the propertied few should be able to participate in the republic. Now, at the time, republicanism was seen as distinct from democracy. Republicanism was seen as a form of self-government, but a form of self-government that would be limited to the virtuous and talented few at the expense of the many who were denied the opportunity to participate actively in the governing structure and in voting. Mm.
And Ted Johnson, the next 245 years mark a lot of progress from that point when the Constitution was adopted. And yet, as I noted in the intro, we're still fighting about how to protect the right to vote for everyone. And fundamentally, I think we still disagree in large measure about how sacred that right is and who ought to have access to the ballot and under what circumstances. It really is a defining part of the debate and the discussion in this country, even today.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, there was a Pew poll that came out a few days ago that suggested something like a third or 40% or so of Republicans now think that voting should be a privilege that that should be earned and that could be revoked. And so even the notion that voting is something fundamental to democracy, sort of superficially, I think we all agree. And then once people start losing elections or their preferred candidates don't win, then suddenly they're okay with the rules being bent a little bit in service of their worldview or their political objectives. So here's the thing, that voting is elections are always about parties trying to shape the electorate in a way that gives them the best chance to win. If a party thinks that expanding the electorate is going to help them win elections, then they will support an expansive conception of voting rights. If parties think that shrinking the electorate is going to help them win elections, then they will support a view that says voting should be a right that has to be worked in order to be exercised, that you have to like work for the access to the ballot, whether that's registration or poll taxes or whatever means they come up with. So whether or not the right is actually fundamental, we can see what we really believe based on the policy preferences of those who hold power. And more times than not, it's not really about a fundamental right. It's about what access or what sort of access to the ballot is going to help my party, my team win elections. And then voting policy tends to emanate from those calculations and not from a common universal understanding that voting is a fundamental right that should be protected for all.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really want to talk about voting rights in two distinct categories. One is the march toward equality along racial lines with voting, which is a fight I think we are probably still having in America. And then I want to talk about it along gender lines. And the narrative there, I think, unfolds very, very differently. But let's start with race. And of course, the first mention in the Constitution about race and voting comes with the Civil War Amendments, 13, 14, and 15. Professor Ross, talk about how important, especially the 14th and 15th Amendments are to the conversation about expanding the franchise to African Americans and prohibiting discrimination in voting along racial lines.
Yeah, they are critically important. And I would say that the Reconstruction Amendments marks a shift from thinking of ourselves as a republic to thinking of ourselves as a democracy, at least under the Constitution. And so the 14th and 15th Amendments establish what I consider the multiracial democracy, or is designed to establish a multiracial democracy, in which the right to vote cannot be denied on account of race or color. And the framers of the 14th and 15th Amendment, I would put emphasis on the 15th Amendment because that was actually the most controversial amendment amongst the Reconstruction Amendment debate. And what they were focusing on was to construct a right to vote, but they understood the right to vote as also providing the opportunity for office holding, the opportunity for broader participation in the governing structure, to integrate a means by which you would integrate legislatures. And they set out on this expansive right to vote that was ultimately decimated in the years that followed. As we saw in the redemption era following Reconstruction, there were successful efforts in the South to deprive African Americans of the vote through different types of voting devices, whether it be different forms of poll taxes or different forms of restrictions, such as early emergence of felon disenfranchisement laws that were had a clear design and an effect of denying and depriving African Americans of the vote. And we have been struggling to overcome that redemption period ever since, with the Voting Rights Act of 65 representing an important and critical innovation in that cause.
And Ted Johnson, it takes almost 100 years after the Civil War amendments for Congress to decide that it needed to come in and act to assure that racial discrimination in voting didn't happen. That's a really long time. And I think sometimes when we think about the right to vote in America and we think about our history, it's lost on people that a constitutional amendment, which is the highest form of revision in our democracy and our most important legal document, it didn't achieve equality along racial lines in voting, and that it took this tremendous act of Congress in the 1960s to give real power to the words that were in the Constitution.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, as was just mentioned, that, you know, once the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments are passed, you have these newly freed and newly enfranchised Black men changing the politics of many states from which they were previously excluded from citizenship and certainly from the ballot box. And there is a backlash to that increased political power of these Black men, which leads into the sort of the redemption period. And that backlash doesn't stop once state houses are recaptured. That backlash continues, as you said, for, you know, 90 years until we get the Voting Rights Act of 65 and begins to sort of re-enfranchise those disenfranchised Black voters in the South, Black men in the South, and then Black women after the 19th Amendment. In the North, there's kind of a different thing happening. Once the Great Migration happens, starting 1900, 1910 or so, you get a lot of voters in the South, who Black voters in the South who couldn't vote, moving to the North, where voting restrictions are much more relaxed and they have access to the ballot in local and state races, and they begin to change the politics of those states. And so suddenly the Black electorate becomes a valuable entity in Northern and some of the Midwestern states, and completely disenfranchised and, or, you know, almost entirely disenfranchised in the Southern states. And now there's this mismatch of what the electorate looks like nationally. And usually when states begin to do these kinds of things, the federal government sooner or later has to get involved, especially on something like voting that's so inherent to the rights and privileges of citizenship. And if the Declaration says that we're a nation where government derives its power from the consent of the governed, voting is how we give that consent. And so the Voting Rights Act of 65 tries to make the nation a bit more whole on the question of voting by protecting civil rights or extending voting rights to those who've been disenfranchised. The last thing I want to say on this, though, is that we can see in Black Americans' voting behavior just how intense the fight for voting rights and, frankly, civil rights writ large has been in the nation's history, and certainly since post-Civil War, except for maybe three or four presidential elections in the early part of the 20th century, Black voters have almost always voted it overwhelmingly in the same fashion for the same party. And they are always voting against the party that is looking to reduce or not enforce civil rights protections, and for the party that makes civil rights protections either a prominent part of its platform or at least signals that it's that it will be important and something that they implement. So Black voters have always voted for the party that would look to extend voting rights, extend civil rights, and then protect those rights, and have never really been able to engage in the American democracy with the full agency of their worldviews around taxes or energy or education or healthcare, because the voting rights fight has been so central to our participation in democracy that it requires that we vote as a bloc for most presidential and congressional elections in order to protect this right to vote mm-hmm. that was supposed to be guaranteed in the Constitution over 100 years ago and supposed to have been guaranteed by congressional legislation 50 years ago. And we still see it under attack, both at the states and in some unfortunate rulings at the Supreme Court.
And Ted, I also like to remind people when I'm talking about this of how long it took to get there, but also how recent it was that we achieved this, at least statutory parity. And I use the example of my own father, who was not able to vote in his home state of Mississippi until the Voting Rights Act was passed. And, you know, I always say this is not some ancestor I read about in a book somewhere. This is the first man I knew. This is the person who helped to raise me. And he experienced the kind of, you know, violent, I think, often discrimination in the South that prevented African-Americans from voting. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when we're talking now about the value of the VRA and when we're talking about these proposals in many states that seem to try to push us back to an earlier time, that time was not a long, long time ago. That time was just a few generations in our past.
Yeah, absolutely right. And in the last decade, certainly since the Shelby County ruling in 2013, but even, you know, really since President Obama's election, we've seen states begin to play with voting regulations and statutes in ways that advantage one party, usually the party in power, and more times than not, it's been Republican parties in the state assemblies, and make it a little bit more difficult for those constituencies that helped Obama win to participate in elections. And what's also interesting is that not only is the voting rights fight recent in terms of disenfranchisement and then sort of finally becoming part of the electorate. And not only does the fight continue in some of the state statutes and Supreme Court rulings, but the resilience of voters to face up to all the hurdles and barriers that states and the government erects in order to insist on their inclusion in democracy also continues. So despite all of the voter suppression laws we've seen across the country, easily in the last decade, last presidential election in November, we saw the highest voter turnout among Black voters generally in the last over a century. Black turnout was especially high in flipped states from 2016, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, Michigan, and certainly in Georgia. So there's this sense that there is no such, you know, voter suppression is a myth, because look at how much higher Black turnout or some of these supposedly oppressed communities have been recently. Mm-hmm. But the resilience of a people doesn't suggest that the attempt to deny their constitutional rights isn't in full effect. It isn't a strategy that's being employed. Both the fight continues and the resilience continues. And that's frankly the story of our country since its inception.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
My guests today are Ted Johnson, who's a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Bertrell Ross, who is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and a constitutional law expert who focuses on election law and voting rights. Voting rights is the subject that we're looking at today, the history of voting rights in the Constitution, in law, and the progress that we've made since the beginning, when the framers excluded an awful lot of people from the franchise, not by accident, quite intentionally, in fact, to today, when I think the presumption is that everybody who's an American ought to have access to the ballot, even though we continue to argue about what that access looks like and what limitations can or should be put on those rights. We want to hear from you as well during this conversation. Give us a call and tell us where you think we are with the right to vote in America. And here's a question that I'd love to hear the answer to from our listeners. Do you think that the right to vote should be built more strongly into the Constitution in a way that really guarantees free and fair elections for everyone? Are we still short of that sort of constitutional goal of really protecting voting rights across the board? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page or to Twitter, and we can include your comments in the show that way. Also, if you are enjoying this book club discussion this summer, there's something happening tonight that I think you would really, really get a kick out of. We are going to give you a chance to come out and share your constitutional knowledge at WDET's We the People Trivia Night. That is at Hopcat in Midtown Detroit tonight at 7 p.m. WDET music hosts Rob Reinhart and Nick Austin are going to be your MCs for what will be a really fun night of constitutional curiosity. You can play in person at Hopcat, or you can actually join virtually from the comfort of your own home. You just need to register to play at WDET.org/events. Okay, before we get to listeners, I want to talk a little about the history of voting rights and gender and equality. Bertrell Ross, women are not protected explicitly in the Constitution as it's adopted initially, and it takes a long time to get to the point where they are. The 19th Amendment, of course, prevents people from being denied the right to vote on the basis of gender. But what's interesting when you compare, I guess, that journey to the journey on race is once that amendment is passed and adopted, that pretty much ends much of the debate about gender. And we don't have that debate today. There isn't a real effort in America by anyone, really, to deny that. And so that's a real contrast, I guess, to the narrative on race, which continues to haunt us in real ways in 2021.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that the closer proximity between women and men, in terms of women often being in the same household as men, can change the dynamics in terms of the voting rights discussion. In terms of prior to the 19th Amendment, the sense that men had were that these Victorian sensibilities, these sexist notions of the place of the woman in the home, and out of politics, because politics was just too, you know, dirty or just not fit for women. Those notions kind of carried some weight. There is some weight associated with the idea that women were dependent on men, and so men would represent them through a form of virtual representation in politics. But once we get to the female empowerment movements that start to emerge in the middle of the 19th century, have carried forward through different sort of waves of feminist movements, even to the present, those ideas get rejected. And to the extent that when the 19th Amendment's passed, this idea that women are dependent, that women don't belong in politics, has been relegated to a sense that it's old-fashioned, it's outdated, and that we need women to be an active part of our polity. Now, there's still a struggle, though, ongoing, and that struggle is perhaps less visible and less noticed, and it has to do with female office holding. Despite the fact that women make up half the population, they make up a much smaller proportion of office holders in the United States. In Congress, they've made up around 25 to 30% over the last decade, which has been a high. Whereas, again, that's a much smaller proportion of the population that they make up. And I think that these are that fact is based on differential opportunities to run for office, and also differential networks in terms of campaign finance and funding opportunities, but also in terms of people's attitudes, in terms of who are the ideal leaders. How do people understand either implicitly or explicitly what leaders are supposed to look like? And that has a gender orientation to it. And that, as a result, has had an effect on female office holding that continues to this day. It's a struggle that we continue to try to overcome.
Mm-hmm. And there's also kind of an overlap of the narratives about racial equality in voting and gender equality in voting, in the sense that a lot of the activists who pushed for the passage of the 19th Amendment were, of course, African-American women who, like other women, wanted to see that barrier fall. And even though the 19th Amendment was adopted, those women, because they were African-American, were still denied the right to vote until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And in that way, there's this kind of bitter irony, I guess, to the 19th.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things to account for is that, just like they are today, women, black women, are the backbones, the foundation of the African-American community. And so when we saw the struggle for the 15th Amendment, there was a strong push and call for African-American women to attach female voting rights for women, and a voting rights amendment for women to that 15th Amendment. But ultimately, there was a decision made, negotiations made to exclude women from that project of voting rights. And so the struggle continued for the next 50 years, and there's quite a bit of tension between these suffrage movements, women's suffrage movements, and sort of this idea that African-American men should govern and should take an important role in terms of representing African-American women. And so what we see in terms of emerging at the time of the Voting Rights Act is this emergence of black women as being an important political force from the 1960s to the present. And so Stacey Abrams, that you had a recording of earlier, she is an example of black women empowerment that has been central to the expression of voice of the African-American communities. Because the fact is, there are many laws in place that have disfranchised disproportionately African-American men. And I'm speaking of laws that disfranchise persons with felony convictions, even after they have completed their terms in prison. And because we know that there is this racial orientation to the criminal justice system, African-American men have been denied voices in ways that are particularly harmful to the African-American community, and women have had to step in to fill that political void.
Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. Call and tell us what you think about the state of voting rights in America. Let's go to Ed in Detroit. Ed, what's on your mind?
A timely conversation.
Thank you.
To steal a line from a deceased politician, can only say the struggle endures. I've thought in recent years a lot about how we run elections and how our peer countries, two dozen to 30 or so mature, wealthy democracies. And in the U.S., elections seem to be confounded by race and over-reliance on political actors. Obviously, your guests have talked about the role of race, but in most of our peer countries, the question of where electoral district boundaries will be and who gets the right to vote are purely technical questions administered by either non-partisan commissions or civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
If you meet the minimal standards to vote, you're eligible to vote. And in this country, we've let political actors manage this process. And as your guests have correctly pointed out, political actors will attempt to jimmy the system for their benefit, whether it's Democrats in Maryland or Republicans in North Carolina. And we need to follow the lead of our peer countries and take this role away from politicians, so that and obviously get race out of it, because mm-hmm. it's not only hurt black people, but in our history, it's also hurt First Nations people and Hispanic and Asian immigrants sure. to the U.S.
Yeah.
at various times and in various places
yeah.
have been adversely affected by the unwillingness of white people, to be frank, to let non-white people vote.
Right.
I'll listen to your guest on the phone.
Ed, I really appreciate the call and the provocative thoughts there. Ted Johnson, I think you were talking earlier about this idea of the ways in which politicians see voting rights as connected to their own fortunes in office. But I think Ed's even going further and saying that, look, if you take away the power that politicians have essentially to choose their voters, right, rather than having voters choose them, that you get closer to some ideal of equality. And here in Michigan, we're actually embarking on that very experiment. In 2018, voters here decided to hand the process of dividing up voters into districts to a nonpartisan commission, or I should say a bipartisan commission, and take it away from politicians. That does connect, I think, to the arguments and the discussions about equality.
Yeah, it does. So just a couple quick notes. The first is when it comes to liberal democracies around the world, we are the longest living constitutional democracy and one of the largest democracies, period. One of the most diverse, and certainly have a unique history relative to other large diverse democracies that exist out there. So part of that history is that we delegate the carrying out of elections to the states, which is to say there are more than 50 sets of rules for how elections are conducted, how voters must register, residency requirements, all these sorts of things in one nation here in the United States. Because if you move from Virginia to North Carolina, there's a whole set of administrative actions you have to take to legally participate in North Carolina's election, even though you were eligible to participate while a resident of Virginia, for example. So that is one thing that makes us distinct, that your geographical location changes how you can access the right to vote, and that there are more than 50 sets of rules here. So that's a problem. Some folks have suggested things like making Election Day a federal holiday. It will incentivize people to go vote, or sort of these redistricting commissions. These are all good ideas, but it doesn't change the fact that there is no one single set of rules for this right we call fundamental to participate in elections in the United States. And so even if we tinker with the systems, we may make elections more fair at the local and state levels, but the national right to vote, to participate in elections, will be left unaddressed. One last quick point on this. Many states have the right to vote in their state constitutions. Mm-hmm. So while it's not in the federal constitution, that right to vote is extended to some extent by the states. So there's you get the post-Civil War right amendment. So it's not like politicians and parties can just run roughshod over the right, but they have become very, very crafty in figuring out the loopholes so that they can construct an electorate that is more advantageous to them than the other party they're running against. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Again, Ed, really appreciate the call and the comments. Let's go to Marge in Macomb Township. Marge, what's on your mind?
Well, the way I look at it, the right to vote is tied into every other vote, right that we have. For example, one is women's rights. If only men can vote on what women can do, women don't have any say over their own bodies. Mm. If only men can tax, they can tax the heck out of properties in an area where they don't want other people to live. Mm-hmm. It just goes on and on and on. If whoever has the power to vote has the power to do many other things.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Marge, that is an absolutely on-point observation and comment, and that gets to the sort of essence of what Stacey Abrams was saying in the quote that we played at the top of the hour. So I really appreciate you taking note of that and adding to the thoughts there.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more Created Equal for you. Now, back to my 2021 conversation about voting rights with Bertrall Ross and Ted Johnson. Today, we are looking specifically at voting rights, one of the most fundamental parts of our democracy and certainly, I think, of our cultural values, the idea of free and fair elections. The question is, how free and fair are elections today? How sacred is the right to vote? How far have we come from the initial adoption of the Constitution, which left a lot of people out of voting rights protections? As always, we want to hear from you. 313-577-1019 is the number here. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter and make comments that we'll try to include in the conversation. Before we get back to listeners, I want to talk a little about some of the things that are going on right now in Congress. There is a bill, H.R. 1, which is the For the People Act, which aims to put into place some federal standards for voting access. It's the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, looks to restore the provisions of the VRA that were gutted in the Shelby County decision a few years ago. I want to talk about that bill in the context of the debate about the Constitution itself. Is what we're facing now a statutory problem that could be fixed by Congress, or is it a constitutional problem that we ought to be going back to the text itself and thinking of ways to change it that would maybe end all of these arguments about voting rights? Bertrall Ross, I will start. I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I mean, I think that in terms of short-term solutions to the voter suppression and partisan use or partisan manipulation of democracy that we face right now, the H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, are important interventions. What they would do is to establish protections at the federal level with respect to access to the ballot by providing provisions for absentee ballots, rules in terms of early voting. They would set up nonpartisan redistricting commissions, and they would restore provisions of the Voting Rights Act that were gutted by Shelby County, as you mentioned. Now, the challenge, however, is that in Congress, under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, has the authority to regulate the time, place, and manner of elections. States have primary authority, but Congress has oversight and regulatory authority with respect to federal elections. So it's completely within congressional power to enact this law. But why I'd say it's also a constitutional solution is that because Congress has this power, a future Congress that is controlled by a different partisan majority who may be more interested in suppressing the vote than expanding the vote can simply repeal the For the People Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Act or limit its effect. And so for a permanent solution, we need to go back to the Voting Rights Act to think about adopting provisions that provide protection for the fundamental right to vote as a positive right rather than something that's protected against discrimination against particular on the basis of particular characteristics. And it's only through those means that we can feel comfortable that these protections will be secured on a more permanent basis.
Hmm. Ted Johnson, you were talking about the protections that exist in some state constitutions for voting rights. Of course, that's not universal. And in states now, we see all of this activity around the idea of trying to limit access to the ballot. Do we need to be thinking about the Constitution and whether it needs amending to make sure that these arguments don't keep taking place?
Yes, absolutely. And it's for, you know, Reverend William Barber has said that Jim Crow didn't die. He went to law school, and now we're fighting James Crow Esquire, because a lot of the tech, the violence and some of these more explicitly racist techniques that were used in the Jim Crow era are resurfacing in very sophisticated legal techniques and political techniques to have the same effect of reducing some groups' ability to participate in elections without the explicit ugliness of the overt racism. So, and you know, the reason this sort of needs constitutional protection is because even if the right to vote is granted in state constitutions, many, like in the state of Virginia, the next line is, but if you've been convicted of a felony, that right is now revoked unless you've been given special pardon by the governor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that which the state gives, the state can also take away, and that creates this patchwork of voting laws and regulations in the country. The other part of this is, and this is something the Supreme Court has weighed in on recently, or actually decided that it wasn't their place to weigh in on, it's that if a party does something that gives them partisan advantage, but it also has the effect of causing racial inequality in access to the ballot, or has a racially disparate effect on the electorate, that as long as, if you cannot prove that it was done for racist reasons, then the Supreme Court said just a couple of terms ago that partisanship and how they jerry-rig districts or these sorts of things, that's not a matter for the courts to decide. If the people don't like what the politicians are doing, they have a remedy. It's the vote, vote them out of office. But if they've jerry-rigged the thing so that people's votes are marginalized or prevented from participating at all, then the vote actually isn't the remedy that it should be to get out some of these unprincipled folks. So in order to address some of the inequality we're seeing in our voting rights laws and protections, we have to address the issue of partisanship, because a lot of the things that are done on a partisan basis, based on the way our parties are presently constructed, have racially disparate impacts that end up hurting the same communities that were harmed in before the Voting Rights Act of 65 was passed. Mm.
Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Al in Pontiac. Al, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey.
My comment is, enjoying the conversation here, my comment is that while the attempts to suppress, the appeal is made coded to race, even though they don't do the overt, ugly racism, it is using race, but particularly demographics and particularly economic status. So the real point of this suppression effort is to harm working people and to harm their voice. It probably pretty much has been that throughout the history of this country, when only landed white men could vote and then more people were included. But the ability to vote really depends on your economic status. If you work a shift or you work hourly and you can't get off of work, how are you going to vote? If you can't get an access to Dropbox, how are you going to vote? So I think the ultimate goal here is economic, that the voice of the lower classes is being suppressed. And albeit, yes, race is a heavy code for that.
Yeah.
Nationality, yeah, and other things. So that's my comment.
Al, that's a really great observation. I'm glad you called and made it. Bertrand Ross, talk about the overlap between the founders' idea that that black people who were enslaved in the South at the time of the ratification of the Constitution would not be able to vote, and even not protecting much of the right to vote in the North for African Americans, and the way that sort of overlaps with the classist nature of what they were doing as well. They didn't think much of people who were not educated, who did not have money, and they weren't all that enthusiastic about protecting their rights either.
No. Al makes an important point here, and I appreciate the caller, his point that he's making in terms of there's a strong and important interaction between race and class here. I described to you earlier in the program how the property elite designed a republic that would exclude the property list because of fear that they would support policies that would redistribute property in ways that were harmful to the property elite. That same concern emerges once you free the formerly enslaved individuals in the South, because they are now the new property list. they are now the new new stakeholders in a democracy. And in many of these southern states, they represented a high proportion of the state, these formerly enslaved individuals, in the sense that they were up to 50% of the people in South Carolina, for example. So if these folks were able to obtain power, then they may have a different view in terms of the property status of the elite and the importance of redistribution and debt relief and different ways of securing economic opportunities for the lower income classes. And I think that that issue persists today. We have to remember this is a capitalist system that we live in which there is huge wealth inequalities. And those who are at the top seek to hold on to their wealth by protecting against laws that might redistribute in the forms of taxation mm-hmm. or other forms of law that cost the rich or the wealthy more money and redistribute some services and funding to the poor. And so we have to understand our voting laws and our voting system partially through that lens, in addition to viewing it through the important lens of race.
Hmm. Ted Johnson, we have a Twitter comment that is kind of related to this question of elitism and voting. John on Twitter says, given the ignorance we see in far too much of those who do vote, both from the left and the right, we should consider finding a mechanism that would require a voter to prove they understood a ballot measure or the candidates on each part of the ballot before they could cast a vote there. I think John is probably well-meaning in what he's suggesting here, but that does reinforce this idea that there are only some people who have, quote-unquote, earned the right to be able to cast their votes, and that has its roots in the inequalities that were part of the nation at its founding.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. If something's a fundamental right, then you shouldn't have to test your way into accessing that fundamental right. So those two things are in tension. The founders were concerned about this stuff. They actually, in the debates around the Declaration, debates around the Constitution, they often refer to the public as being too fickle to be trusted with the levers of government. And that's why a republic was necessary, so that enlightened patriotic men could temper the easily maneuvered and easily duped public and ensure government is stable. So there's that issue. The second one is what we've seen basically during Jim Crow, that if you say, okay, there has to be a bare minimum knowledge to participate in this right, then the tests that are devised, the questions that are asked, the implementation of these tests will often be done in ways that intentionally discriminate or complicate the access to the ballot by folks who are the undesirable voters in the electorate. So something that's supposed to test one's knowledge of their ability to participate in the franchise, questions about when was the nation founded or when was the Declaration of Independence signed, quickly become how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap. Mm-hmm. And the same government that issues the test employs the people that administer the questions and check for correctness. And that is an opportunity to introduce some, discrimination there as well. So it's the testing is not foolproof, but I will say that there is a need in the United States for a stronger program of civic education.
Yes.
And not just, when was the Constitutional Convention and how many branches of government, but are we training people how to be active citizens in our country, beyond voting, beyond paying taxes, but being active, daily, responsible, participatory citizens in America in a way that is pro-democratic. And I think we've got some work to do there. And that way, if we've got a stronger program of civic education, you create better informed voters without requiring them to score an 80% on a test that some politician dreamed up.
That's it for my conversation with Bertrell Ross and Ted Johnson. We originally recorded that on Detroit Today in 2021 as part of the WDET Book Club about the Constitution. That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobin. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.